Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much, we chiseled them all on a bunch of stones and made people memorize them.
Yeah, so we basically went back to the stone tablet system.
Yeah. So be expecting your stone tablet in the mail and get memorizing henceforth.
That's right. And if you don't, we'll do something bad to you. We haven't figured out what yet.
Yeah, not entirely sure.
Yeah, but you won't like it.
You'll probably just die like in a volcanic eruption, so.
Yeah, that's true. You know,
no big. So, I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
And this week we read, or this week, this month, this cycle, we read The Fifth Season by N.K. Jemisin. And this book is actually super recent. I noticed it came out in August. So I would like to instate our spoiler policy for this one because it is like 2 months old.
Yeah, this one is definitely worth putting the spoiler alert out on, especially because there are some, not only some plot relevant things that you may not want spoiled, but even just the narrative structure of the book itself is kind of a spoiler.
Very true. So, we talk about the whole book, blah blah blah, we will give you spoilers, all of that jazz. And if you don't enjoy spoilers, then we recommend you go out and read the fifth season before listening to this podcast. And I guess, spoiler alert, we would recommend that you read the fifth season. So, you won't be hurting yourself that much. Yeah. Because, spoiler bomb, Ben?
All three of the point of view characters are the same character.
What?
What?
That one is... It's fairly surprising, I would say. I started getting a sense of a little bit of it, but it wasn't until the end that I was like, oh, shit. Yeah, all three of them, same person. It helps that the characters in this book can kind of change names at certain points in their life, and it's not, like, really weird or obvious or, like, unusual.
Right.
For someone to have, like, five different names, so...
It's like, oh, hey, this... It's weird. This Jane is 10, and this one is 25, and this one is 45. I wonder if they're the same person.
Yeah, nothing quite like that.
What a weird coincidence that there'd be three viewpoint characters with the same name.
I never would have expected it.
And we didn't figure it out because we are idiots.
I don't think many people probably heard of this book, so... Part of the inspiration for it is Ben and I, which we've mentioned in earlier podcasts, we're trying to find more books written by women, and particularly we're looking for more books written by people of color, women of color, just because we kind of have to try not to read whiteys all the time, which is really sad. So this one seemed like a great opportunity because N.K. Jemisin is, in fact, a black woman. Ben, why don't you go ahead and just explain, like, how you found the book?
Sure. So, John Scalzi, who is very much a white man, has a fairly well-trafficked blog. If you're in the science fiction universe at all, you probably know who he is, at least. But he runs a feature on his blog called The Big Idea, where authors can kind of explain the idea behind their book, and... N.K. Jemisin was featured on one of these, and actually, aside from that, it turns out he's kind of a fan of hers anyway. And now that I've read one of her books, I know why, because I thought this book was pretty badass. But she had a dream of a woman power walking towards her with a mountain floating in the air, kind of in tow. And it occurred to her that someone doesn't just wake up one morning and decide to lift a mountain, but that they probably were driven to that, probably through years of maltreatment, shall we say. And this is the book that resulted from that, even though that scene never actually appears in the book.
Yeah, I was going to say, spoiler alert, that scene never actually happens. I was very sad.
Though it's the first of a trilogy, a planned trilogy, so who knows, maybe by the end it happens.
Yeah. And you can tell that John Scalzi is a fan of hers, because he actually wrote the blurb on the back of the book, so.
Yeah.
There you go.
So there you go.
But it's pretty cool. John Scalzi, for all of his being a white man-ness, does a good job of trying to find people in his realm of the world who are not. So I appreciate that about him.
Yeah, he realizes that it's not good for science fiction if all of the participants and gatekeepers are all white men, just like they were 50 years ago.
Yeah, who all write stories about white men.
Right.
Yeah, so based on that, the fact that Ben found this on John Scalzi's blog, I have automatically been thinking about it as science fiction from, like, the get-go. But Ben did point out while we were outlining that it is sort of just a straight-up fantasy story. It's actually kind of more fantasy than science fiction, but there's some science fiction-y stuff, I guess, in there. So, that kind of made my brain hurt, and I was sad.
I was kind of glad, though, that you were stuck on the science fiction idea, because that let us speculate on how that setting could come around in a science fiction context instead of a fantasy context.
Yes. And it'll be interesting to see, because it is the first book of a trilogy, so it'll be interesting to see if the next two books have more science fiction-y elements or not.
Yeah, so the, I guess just kind of in that vein, the setting, is a world with, it's really one continent on a world, that is very tectonically active. So I just had kind of assumed it was just some fantasy place, like a Middle Earth or something along those lines, with, if you're thinking science fiction a little more, though, it could be, you know, an alternate universe, an alternate Earth. It could be a far future Earth. It could be some colony world, except that the historical background for this society is stated to be like 15 or 16,000 years old. So it would be pretty far future, actually, in any of those possible settings. Even just the plain, so to speak, fantasy, different world made up sort of place.
Yeah, even if it was just like a regular old, like, Earth-like planet with its own history. I mean, the people on this planet have been around for a long time, and they've all been existing in different types of civilizations. So that was one of the things I kind of liked about this world, was there have been a bunch of past civilizations that they call dead civs, who've left, like, little remnants of themselves, so they know, you know, oh, in the past there was a civilization that had giant floating obelisks in the air, for example, but they don't know why they created them or why those things are there. So we know that, if nothing else, they've had technologically advanced people on this planet before the current day setting of the book.
We don't know if that's because they were high-tech settlers from another world. We don't know if they developed it themselves. Certainly, even in a fantasy setting, it's not entirely unusual for there to have been some more advanced past version of civilization. You know, thinking of the Wheel of Time, where I'm pretty sure they had, like, hover cars and energy weapons and stuff in one of the distant past ages, even though it was definitely like a standard medieval fantasy setting at the time that the story takes place.
Or the history of the real world, then, with the lost city of Atlantis.
Oh, right. I forgot about their crystal spires and togas.
If you guys want an hour of hilarious podcasting, I suggest listening to the Atlantis episode of Monster Talk, so you can hear an angry archaeologist talk about how it does not exist.
Yeah, how the people who think Atlantis is a thing, it's basically just a case of poor reading comprehension.
Yes. So, plot synopsis.
Yeah, we just used a Twitter exchange that we had when Gabs was reading the book. The fifth season, a lesson in why it's a bad idea to oppress people who can create volcanoes through an act of will.
I think that's solid advice.
If you have to systematically oppress people, don't choose anyone, now that I think about it.
I really liked that tweet. If you have to systematically oppress people, don't choose the powerful people. Well, systematically oppress anyone.
Hey guys, just don't oppress people.
But we will say that they did make poor decisions.
Yes.
Yeah, so for a summary of this book, we're not actually going to give like a full summary of what happens, because there's a lot of stuff that happens, and three different people, point of views, and all this stuff. So we're just going to kind of give a basic background. So we mentioned that the planet and this particular continent on this planet, we don't even know if this planet has other continents or not, has super active plate tectonics. And every once in a while, they have something they call a season or a fifth season, where one of the there's a tectonic shift that like causes acid rain for 100 years or something like that. So like everything just goes insane and kills a bunch of people. And the people have like developed ways of hopefully living through these various seasons. So there are some people living on this planet called Orogenes, and they have the ability to affect the Earth around them, basically through, like, the power of their mind and touching the Earth and stuff. So, like, you know, they can start an earthquake or stop an earthquake, for example. But everyone is really scared of them, because if you're an untrained Orogene kind of running around, if you get pissed at somebody, you could accidentally kill them without really meaning to, using rocks or something like that. So the capital has started this whole training system at this place called the Fulcrum, where they take all the Orogenes they can find and train them to focus their power and all this stuff. But kind of as you go along and discover, the Orogenes are not, they're not being done a favor by being taught how to harness their power. They're actually, you know, being forced to harness their power. And holy moly. harness their power in a very specific way, and they're kind of forced to do some shitty things. So that's kind of the basic overview of the world, just so you have like a context for what the heck we're talking about.
Yes, and also for context of what the heck you're talking about, Erica is watching K-State play football in the other room, and she gets excited.
She's not just getting excited at things we're talking about.
That would be awesome. There are people on this planet called Orogenes. Woo!
All right! So you explain the point of view of this book, because it's pretty nuts.
Yeah, so the book uses that narrative structure that, if you're a reader, I'm sure you've seen, where there are multiple point of view characters and it kind of rotates chapters between them. And as we already mentioned, they turn out to be the same person at three different stages in her life. And then on top of that, two of the three are written in third person, but one of the three is written in second person. That's actually the first chapter, the oldest and therefore current version of this character. A character named Essen, who the opening of the story is basically that she gets home and her husband and daughter have disappeared after her husband beat her young son to death.
Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah. And as you go through her life, though, it's pretty fairly late in the book when it's revealed they're the same person. It turns out that's more or less par for the course for her life.
Yeah.
And that among the class of people she belongs to, she arguably may not even have it the worst.
That's what I was going to say, is that, like, her treatment doesn't even seem, like, particularly egregious as far as origins go.
Yeah.
Which is sad.
Well, it's certainly, yeah. And, I mean, for example, when she's in the chapters where she's going by Cyanite, which is, like, her as a young woman, I guess we don't know exactly how old, but probably...
20s?
Yeah, 20-something. She's traveling with another origin named Alabaster, and it turns out that part of this origin control system is they have a breeding program. So while they fear and hate them, they're also trying to create stronger and stronger ones. And it's most of his kids are very powerful, but instead of going to the trouble to train them and risk having them rebel, they just surgically alter their brains and strap them to basically like a creepy life support frame of some sort in places around the Empire so that they'll just by reflex and intuition suppress earthquakes in their area.
Yeah.
So he's a little upset with this power structure as it exists.
Understandably.
Yeah.
I think.
And the bookends of the bookends of the novel are him more or less ripping the continent in half because he's pissed.
Yes, pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, we find out, so like he creates the fifth season that's happening in this book, and people are used to those happening. But it's definitely said that this one is going to be much more damaging and last a lot longer than the previous ones that people have experienced. Like, thousands upon thousands of years sorts of long.
Yeah, because things that happen on a geological scale are not especially comprehensible on a human scale, I think.
Yeah.
Is the lesson.
So George R.R. Martin's 10 years of winter got nothing on this shit.
That's right. Sounds like some of the fifth seasons were only a couple of years long, but they're all pretty disastrous events.
Yeah, they're pretty bad.
Yeah.
Okay, so as we've discussed, when we were trying to figure out the protagonist, we were like, well, since all three point of view characters are the same person, they're kind of all the protagonist. But Essen, who is like the current day, the oldest version of herself, we think she's probably the closest to being like the straight protagonist because she's the version of herself that has the most agency. And I don't know exactly what's going to happen in future books, but I would imagine in future books we're probably just going to be following Essen and probably not Cyanite and Demaya anymore. So I think the oldest version of her is the most protagonist-y, personally.
Yeah, she is no longer in thrall to the fulcrum. I mean, she's not entirely in control of her circumstances just because this fifth season starts and the people in her village know what she is, mainly because her village wasn't destroyed.
Yeah.
And because of that, she can't stay, which... seems kind of like backwards logic to me, but no accounting for fantastical racism, I guess.
Well, she also has to go find her husband and kill him for killing their son.
Well, so. there is that whole thing.
And get her daughter back.
Yeah, and she has some freedom of movement because of that. If she wanted just to have a tantrum and... destroy as many things as she could until she accidentally caused a volcano under herself or something, then I guess she could do that.
She could.
So, she does have some ability to choose what she wants to do. I mean, I guess if she wanted just to kill everyone in the village and sit on the storehouse until someone friendly came along, she could do that too. But
yeah,
it's a hard world, and she is a hard person because of it.
Yeah. Excuse me. I am getting over a cold. What's interesting about Essen is we were kind of talking about, like, all stages of her, like, have anger going on, but how Essen has, like, the most, like, focused and productive anger, I guess, and the deepest anger. And that's, like, part of her is her anger, but I thought it was kind of interesting that, like, even though all this terrible stuff has happened to her, her son got killed, she's, like, trying to find her daughter, she's angry with everyone and, like, her whole situation, she's still not, like, a mean person. Like, I thought it was kind of interesting how she took Hoa in.
Yeah.
Reluctantly, but, you know, not everyone would have just let this really weird kid thing follow them around and, like, take care of it. So, she still has, like, some of that caring nature, I think, kind of buried under there, despite her best efforts, probably.
Yeah, I mean, the youngest version of her, who goes by Demaya, is kind of a fairly normal young girl.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, you know, like, almost some, the kid who discovers they have powers and gets to go to the fantastical academy, though it very quickly is demonstrated how the fulcrum is not going to be anything like Hogwarts in her case.
Yeah, when her hand gets broken.
Yeah, for no reason other than to prove that her keeper guardian can control her, basically.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that version of her is curious about things and interested in maybe making some friends and doing the things that kids do. And then as Cyanite, which is her young adult self, she's pretty much just pissed off at everything all the time. That's pretty much that version of her character.
Yeah.
And then as an older middle-aged person, like, has some perspective on all of that stuff and still knows it's been incredibly unfair and is still pretty angry at the world for what it's done to her, but without going all the way to, like, the icy, controlled, unstoppable, like, not interesting, kind of, because they're too badass type of character.
Yeah. Well, that's what makes her character feel real, is, like, in her middle-aged iteration, I guess, she still has emotions. This is something that I noted, was that she doesn't have to be totally, like, faceless, emotionless badass. She can still, like, be a person who has feelings. But then I really appreciated how the fact that she has feelings is not, like, interpreted as, well, here's this, like, pissed off person who's crazy and is gonna fly off the handle and, like her emotions are gonna get the better of her because she's a woman or whatever the fuck.
Right.
They're just, like, you know, she feels them deeply, she deals with them, and I just thought it was cool that, like, how well-rounded she is, because you usually see, like, either kind of detached, emotionless, badass type of character, or, like, totally out of control, like, unable to control themselves, sort of angry.
Yes.
This is a nice in-between.
Yeah, or for that matter, when she takes Hoa in, it's more of like a survival type of pact than just the, oh, we just show how the angry person with superpowers is also maternal because they're a woman.
Yes.
Not that anybody would do that.
No, never. Well, that's something I thought was kind of interesting about her character, is that, like, as Cyanite, even though she, like, has a kid, she's not maternal, like, pretty much whatsoever. And then as Essen, I think she has definitely, like, a greater connection to those kids. But it was kind of interesting to see how she was, like, changing with, like, what was happening to her, and it wasn't just, like, yeah, it wasn't just, like, oh, I want kids, or I'm too cool to have kids.
Well, and a big part of the difference, for that matter, was that as Cyanite, she had to have a kid as part of this breeding program.
Yeah.
And then as Essen, the two kids she had were with someone she actually wanted to marry and actually have kids with.
Yeah. It's a little different there.
Yeah, so, you know, being able to make the choice makes you look at it a lot differently.
Fair enough. And that's what this book is all about. Choice, right? Being able to make choices.
There you go.
Yeah. All right, so, yeah, I guess, should we talk about other people besides Essen / Cyanite / Demaya?
Sure.
Okay.
I talked about Alabaster earlier and how he ripped a continent in half.
Yeah.
So if you want to talk about people with superpowers, he's the person with the most of them.
Yeah, he's like the most, he is the most powerful origin on the continent.
Yeah. And did so faster than most people get to anything approaching that level of power, apparently. Because they indicate how powerful people are by the number of rings they wear. And so Cyanite is a four-ringer and only a step or two away from having enough power to enter the leadership ranks for, well, such as they are, even though they're carefully controlled. Well, Alabaster's a 10-ringer, and at some point when he gets introduced, Cyanite is thinking, oh, shit, I think the most I've seen before is 8 or 9, and it was on some, and they were on people who were like 75 years old.
Yeah. And Alabaster's like, what, in his 30s?
Yeah. So he's a natural.
What is happening over there?
Beer is happening. I'm sitting next to the beer fridge.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah, so Alabaster, at first, Cyanite thinks, oh my gosh, like, he's a 10-ringer, he's pretty young, he's more powerful than anyone, he can basically do whatever the fuck he wants, he can, like, say whatever he wants, he can, you know, take people in or turn them away. He has all this power that, like, I don't have and that other origins don't have. But then she discovers as the book goes on that he is just as trapped as everyone else, and he's, a lot of bad stuff has been done to him, too. Like, forcing him to sleep with a bunch of women he doesn't want to sleep with to have children who become slaves.
Yeah. And especially because if it was up to him, he might not want to sleep with women at all.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like it.
And he's a very, he's also a very angry person, though his is really, it kind of shows up in the form of him, lashing out verbally occasionally, or, you know, tearing a continent in half, but for the most part seems to be, more channeled into resignation. And just kind of a broken person. He seems miserable about 90% of the time you're around him.
Yeah. He is not a happy human being.
No.
I mean, understandably, but...
Yes.
He's kind of... We had Alabaster who, like, knows everything that's going on. He's just, like, basically been completely destroyed by it, but is resigned to it, more or less, like, what he has to do. And Cyanite / Essen, like, on the flip side, she's, you know, started learning those things, but when we see her, like, in her, when she's older, she has not quite let the system break her. So, Alabaster kind of resigns himself to it, and Essen tries to continue to break away from it, and doesn't let it completely, like, destroy her, so.
So, I guess moving along,
Yeah.
Hoa, who is a child, he seems weird from the get-go, and then very quickly quickly seems even weirder, and then in very short order after that, you realize he's not actually human at all. There's some sort of race of creatures called Stone Eaters on this planet, and we actually don't have a very good idea of who they are, what they think, what they want, and what they're capable of, but we know we know that even a powerful origin couldn't really go toe-to-toe with one of them if one of them got pissed off at you.
Yeah, it kind of seems like origins, like, even though some people might claim they're not human or whatever, like, an origin and a let's say, regular human, a still, I think is what they call them, can, like, sleep together and have a kid, but Stone Eaters are kind of, like, their own breed of creature. Like, they can look like people, but they're not people.
Right. And so, like, they can move effortlessly through stone.
Yeah, for example.
That's kind of significant. And again, we don't really know what they want. We find out that there are probably factions of them by the end of the book, but we don't know what they represent or what they want.
Yeah.
So lots of mystery there after one book, and then Hoa seems to feel some sort of attachment to Essen. Though again, again, as of the ending of the first book, we don't really know why, though she does seem to have some ability to communicate with or draw power from the weird floating obelisks that most origins don't have.
Yeah. So we can't say exactly that Hoa likes Essen, because we don't really know how Stone Eaters, like, if they have feelings.
Right.
But he seems to like her. He tries to protect her. He has some kind of interest in her, and for some reason, like, looks like a kid, but is definitely not a child.
Yeah, I don't know if they would ever have, like, a relationship that would have a true human equivalent, but I am pretty sure if you tried to hurt her and he was around, you might get turned into stone or something.
Yeah. I was going to say, turned into stone and then, like, shattered into a thousand pieces.
Yeah, so try not to do that.
Probably a good idea. Yeah, so, moving on?
Yeah.
Because we've been talking a lot about, I just realized this looking at the outline, but talking about all of the characters, you're also kind of talking about groups of people who live on this world while, like, you're talking about a character. So, you know, Essen and Alabaster as origins, Hoa as a Stone Eater. And then our next character on the list, Shaffa, he represents the Guardians, who are the people who, like, are in charge of the origins. It seems like they kind of get them when they're young and then sort of, like, help train them and look over them and keep them in line, because they'll, like, fuck you up real bad if you don't. And we can't quite figure out exactly what the hell is going on with the Guardians. They have some weird stuff going on. It's hard to tell, like, you know, when they say, like, I want what's best for you. Essen, when she's a child as Demaya really thinks, you know, Shaffa loves me and I think I love him, but then if I don't do what he asks me to do, he'll, like, break all the bones in my hand. So, it's a pretty screwed up relationship. And we then discover towards the end of the book that guardians specifically have to be the children of origins, but they are the children of origins who do not have that power. And for some reason, the fact that So they're a Harry Potter equivalent. They're squibs. But the fact that they are children of origins, like, gives them some kind of other weird power where they can, like, turn it back on other origins and destroy them. So,
yeah, it gives them, like, some sort of connection to that power without having the ability to actually use it, it seems.
Yeah.
But, And apparently...
They, like, tamp it down and...
Yeah. Like, they can suppress the power of Origenes, or I guess some of them at least can do to a person what an earthquake does to a building just by skin-to-skin contact.
Yeah.
I don't know what that looks like, but I kind of don't want to.
It sounds pretty scary.
Yeah.
yeah, so we don't really get to know Shaffa that well, but we... He's kind of the representative for the Guardians, and we're hoping we get to learn more about their weirdness in following books. So.
Yeah, we get a couple glimpses of them, and it's implied that they know a lot more than the reader knows as well. So, I mean, yeah. I think it's part of... I mean, I don't think it's giving anything away to say that I liked this book a lot, but I think one of the reasons I do is that there's clearly a depth of world building and plotting going on here, even though we haven't seen a lot of it yet.
Oh my gosh, it opens up, I think Ben and I had like 12 billion questions. And it's like, if books 2 and 3 do a good job of answering those questions, it's going to be badass. And if they do a terrible job, then you're like, fuck this book.
It would be so frustrating.
Like, all the fans of Lost, who are just like, fuck this show.
So I guess going on, we have a representative of the regular old humans, in on a, let's see, what's the word I'm looking for? That actually was not the word I was looking for. But he's a, he's a big, I'm looking for this word. Boastful's not the word I'm really looking for. Exuberant. Like, full of life.
Yeah.
He's a pirate.
Which is awesome. Yeah, he's the sort of person who, like, walks into a room and is like, here's this crazy story, and everyone's like, ooh, and they, like, go listen to it, and they're like, you're the greatest, Anna. Like, that kind of guy.
Oh,
not
man.
Not in an annoying way.
Right. Like, the Inon always has the best stories. One of those people who tells lots of stories, but you actually want to hear them.
Yeah, yeah. And he's just, like, a nice dude who cares about people.
Yeah, and he has a kind of a... three-cornered pseudo-marriage thing going on with Cyanite and Alabaster.
Yeah, Cyanite and Alabaster do not like having sex with each other, but they both really like having sex with Inon. Who, it seems, in turn, quite enjoys having sex with both of them, so...
Yes, either separately or together. Inon is not as choosy as they are.
Yeah.
And so that's basically the time when they're on the island with him is pretty much the only time the two of them get to be happy in this story.
Yeah, where they think they've escaped the powers of the Fulcrum and, like, kind of get to do their thing and have a good time. But, of course, that can't last for very long.
Right. Well, and especially since Essen was there when she was still known as Cyanite, then clearly it was not meant to last.
Yeah. Although we don't know that when you're reading it, necessarily.
That's true. Only in hindsight do we know that.
So, do you want to hit on this last person?
Sorry. That last squeaking was followed by an oh.
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so there is one more member of the traveling party. Of Essen's traveling party when she's trying to hunt down her husband. And that is a woman known, I guess, also who has two different names in two different parts of the story, but...
Yeah.
She goes by Tonki when we meet her and from Essen's point of view.
Tonki! Yeah, and Essen finds out later on that she actually did meet Tonki when she was younger. So when Essen was Demaya, she met Tonki when Donkey was Binoff. That's not confusing as hell.
That's right. Everybody got that?
But Tonki is the sort of character who has, she's part of the leadership cast, which is basically on this planet, like the people who are in charge of everything. But she was too mischievous and troublesome, basically, like for her cast, because she just wanted to know too much and breaking the rules all the time. So her family thought, well, the easiest way to deal with this is to ship her off to university, like change her name, and they give her a fresh start doing something that she won't cause a bunch of trouble doing, basically. So the cool thing about Tonki and Binoff is she kicks off like Essen's whole journey because she and Maya find this like weird pit thing that we're guessing like an obelisk was in. And they're trying to figure it out, and that's about the time where Demaya, like, shit starts kind of getting real for her, and she has to, like, become the true origin with rings or whatever. So that's kind of cool. She, like, kicks off her story, like, into becoming an adult. Wow. I have no clue where I was going with that.
But then shows up.
Oh, yeah.
So kind of starts her down this path, and then later at the as she's an adult and has gone through all this stuff and is now kind of on her new path, and probably from the shape of the story is probably going to be looking into some of the same things that she saw as Demaya when she was with Binoff, now that she's with Tonki.
What?
Right. So, I mean, there's some parallelism, I guess. And Tonki herself is she's very curious. She's a researcher. That's what... So she's a geomest, which seems to be an academic who is interested in geology especially, but seems to be a little broader than just that.
Yeah. And then kind of the cool thing about Tonki is it's just mentioned in passing, like she's always, Essen always sees her as a girl, she's always referenced to as a she, and then there's one scene where you find out that she is not biologically, whoa. where you find out that Tonki is not biologically female, which means that we have a trans woman in this book, which is kind of fabulous that it's just like, oh yeah, by the way, there it is, moving on. So I liked that aspect that she was like a full character, and that was just kind of like a quick little side note, and other than that, wasn't a thing.
Yeah, like her issues with her family had to do with being a weirdo because she wasn't interested in leadership rather than being a weirdo because she didn't follow some gender norm.
Yeah. Like, that didn't seem to be a problem for anybody.
And, as you know, at Novel Ideas, we like that kind of thing.
We do enjoy that kind of thing. That actually leads great into moral issues of feminism and diversity.
Yes.
So that was something about this book overall that I just thought was fantastic, was that there was a great range of characters of various genders, sexualities, and races. People's skin colors dropped fairly often because in this particular society there's like a standard of beauty, and so and like certain types of hair and like stature and skin color and stuff that you want to be like the most beautiful or whatever. So the narrator or like whoever POV character is like makes fairly often like makes note of what people look like because that's like a thing. But it was interesting that there's like a huge range of people that white people are actually like not super common. Definitely not the beauty standard, and I just thought it was cool, like, all the characters, like, range all over the spectrum, but it never feels forced. Like, I never felt like N.K. Jemisin was like, okay, well, now I need to make sure I'm including, like, a brown woman, and now I need to make sure I'm including, like, a dude who is not straight, and now, you know, like, it just kind of seemed to come naturally, and I think it was because a lot of the time it was sort of, like, incidental to who they were, as opposed to, like, their defining characteristic. And so that's just cool, like, as someone who's a conscious consumer of media, if you're, like, looking for things like that, this book does a freaking awesome job, like, hitting all that stuff. But then also just being a good story and not a story about, you know, women and stuff like that, so.
Right. and then, I guess, kind of on the flip side of that, the origins and kind of all the structure of society built specifically around them is clearly an example of systemic oppression of a group of people. And you can pretty easily make some parallels to slavery in the United States or to Jim Crow in the United States, or that being the country whose history I'm most familiar with and live in, but presumably probably other examples of oppression around the world as well.
Yeah, and they talked about, like, the breeding program for the origins. Slavery was, like, one of the first things I thought of was, oh, like, make sure you get your biggest and strongest slaves to make more big, strong slaves. Like, that's essentially exactly what they're doing. And when you start thinking about it in those terms, like, you should already be pissed off at what they're doing to the origins, hopefully. You start thinking of it in those terms, you're like, oh, fuck, it's even worse than I thought. Like, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, so, I mean, it kind of...
I was like, I feel like I should have a follow-up to that, but yeah. It's just pretty bad.
And like, where else do you go with it? And since that's kind of the start of our theme section here, too, you know, it's... That does seem to be one of the big themes of the book, is that, hey, oppressing people is bad, and when you do it, that's going to make them very angry. And in this setting, the people who are oppressed also happen to have some pretty wild powers and abilities, and that's going to come back around and get you a lot more directly than the decades of legal wrangling and changing attitudes in society it usually takes to shift to those things.
Yes. So I know here at Novel Ideas, you hear us tell you that slavery and oppression are bad a lot, but clearly you have not learned your lesson, because once again, just in case you didn't know, you should not oppress people. It makes them feel bad and hurts their lives and might make them turn around and kill you. So
it's true. I mean, and we just keep telling you, but despite all of that, you just
haven't figured it out.
Kind of weird, given our proclivities, how many of our audience, at least based on what we tell them, seem interested in holding slaves or...
believe that women are not equal.
Right. So, just stop it, guys. Come on.
Yeah. Jeez, get over it.
Looking at our... looking at our points of interest, looks like we've mentioned pretty much all of them already.
I just want to bring up the floating obelisks one more time.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if I've quite gotten across how weird these things are when I was reading the book. So, like, these obelisks are from a dead sieve. And they're just these enormous freaking obelisks, like stone obelisks, floating in the sky. And at first I thought, oh, they're, like, markers, like landmarkers. But no, they just kind of float around. Like, they can move around and kind of go wherever. And you find out later on that they can, like, follow origins around. And apparently they're the source of a bunch of power, where you can do things. And no one, like, gives them a second thought, and these things just baffle the hell out of me.
Right, so, like, imagine looking out your window, and there's an Amethyst Washington Monument floating there. And it's been going on for so long that when you look at it, you don't think anything of it, and turn around and go turn around and go back to watching TV.
It's like, no, whatever. Normal day. It's cloudy out. All right. What?
Well, those have been those seemed relevant enough in a couple of places that it would be pretty surprising if we didn't learn more about them when the next book comes out.
I hope so. That was like my number one question. I was like, what the hell is up with those obelisk things?
Yeah, and in fact, when I look at our questions on the outline, that's the first one there. What are the Stone Eater factions going to do? Where do the Guardians get their power?
And 12,000 other questions that we have.
It could reel them off.
What the heck is going on?
So our verdict, again.
Oh, we didn't talk about strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
Oh, right? Totally skipped it. My bad.
You dick.
Well, the narrative structure is interesting. The world building is deep and complex, as are the characters.
Yes.
despite
last point. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, despite, like, the kind of the brooding, epic thing that's probably going to happen and all of the oppression of these characters, it doesn't take itself so seriously that you feel like you have to come up for air every 10 pages.
Yeah, so something I really liked about this book was, like, there was legitimate jokes and humor in it. Whereas, like, a lot of the times I feel like when you read epic fantasy stories, for example, let's go with Lord of the Rings here. So in the books, basically nothing funny happens in those books whatsoever. They're just, like, super serious. And one of the reasons I think people like the movies, I think there are many reasons people like the movies, but, is that Peter Jackson was like, I'm going to put in some jokes in here so that funny things happen occasionally.
Right.
Which, like, you know, if you have a serious story, you sometimes need humor to lighten it up. And if you have a humorous story, you usually need a little bit of seriousness to kind of tie it down. So that's something I thought was great about this book was that, like, right off the bat, it was pretty snarky, like, the first chapter. The narrator's just like, oh yeah, the world's ending, whatever, get over it. So, I thought that was like a great element of the writing, and I really liked it.
Well, I'll add to that idea a little bit and say that a lot of stories I've read kind of get that little bit of humor or levity by having one character who's a nonstop snark master, and This story does it more subtly than that. And I even say that as someone who usually likes the snark knight type of character.
You do. I do not as much, so I appreciate the subtler approach.
I think it has its place. If you're writing a story where that type of character makes sense, you know, like in the Dresden universe, I think it makes sense for there to be characters who do that because that's clearly who the protagonist is and what the world is. In something like Lord of the Rings, if you dropped someone like that into that story, it would be so out of place, surrounded by all of those humorless people.
Yeah, it would be real weird. But hilarious.
Yes, though, in a different way. Like if you were writing a parody story, it would be hilarious. Yeah. It's like one of those movies they make where they have, yeah, like one of those parody movies, basically, where you have, like, Jack Black play the hero or something.
Yeah. Okay, now we can go into our verdict.
Oh, now I don't want to.
Oh, fine.
No, I think it's pretty obvious that, that I loved this book. I've been suggesting to everybody I know who reads fantasy that they should read it.
Yeah, this book. I found it immediately engaging, and when I finished it, excuse me, and I kind of thought over the books that I've read for the past year or so, I would say this is definitely near, if not at the top of the list. So I have also been recommending it to all of my friends here in Boston as something they should definitely read.
Yeah, so get on that, everybody.
Yeah, geez.
what are you reading right now?
Yeah, so I actually just finished all six Mediator books by Meg Cabot. I think I mentioned those a podcast ago or something, about a teenage girl who, like, talks to ghosts and stuff. And those were pretty fun. And I just finished today reading Shadow Shaper.
Oh, all right.
So.
An upcoming episode of Novel Ideas.
Indeed.
I also recently finished Shadow Shaper. I also have read a pretty quick little two-book series by Lexi Dunn, Superheroes Anonymous and the sequel Supervillains Anonymous, which is actually another thing I found out of that big idea feature, because she said, hey, you see all these epic heroes in movies and comic books and whatnot, but what about, like, the sidekick character who has relatively minor powers, and if they want to go fight the villain and they're on the opposite side of the city, they have to, like, hop the L and wait 20 minutes to get there.
Which is a great concept.
Which is a great concept. So, yeah, I enjoyed it. It was cute, and its protagonist was one of those snarky types.
So even better.
That's right.
Yeah. Perfect. So, I think that's it. So, if you want to get in touch with us, you can find us at our website at www.novelideaspodcast.com. And we are now part of the Minerva Podcast Network. So, you can also find us via Minerva's website at www.minervamag.com.
And you should do both of those things.
I think.
especially Minerva, if you want to go find other geeky content by smart people, though, by saying that, I realize I've just claimed we're smart people, so there's some danger in that, maybe. But if you questions, comments, etc., could be directed to our Twitter feed at Novel Ideas Pod, which is really me, or at Classic Sum Up, which is really Gabs.
yeah, basically. And we will theoretically get back to you if you tweet at us. I'll definitely get back to you if you tweet at me. It might take me a day or two, depending on how busy my class schedule is that week. But and you can also find us on iTunes and subscribe there. And you can rate, review, leave comments, whatever you want, over on iTunes. So those are all fantastic options for telling everyone you know to listen to Novel Ideas.
Hey, there you go. Help people find us. And so I think that's going to do it this week. I am reasonably confident that our next scheduled episode is, in fact, going to be Shadow Shaper.
Nice.
It is possible that there will be a bonus episode or two somewhere coming up. It might actually be before this episode instead of after it, but I'm trying to get... I don't want to promise anything, but I'm trying to get one or two things together.
Very nice.
Especially with Banned Book Week coming right up here.
Yeah.
As of the time of recording, which might be a month before this gets posted. But but that's all right. So I guess that'll do it this time. And
yep.
We'll see you later.
Bye.